Hello, and welcome to this episode of Felonious, a podcast where we discuss the realm of true crime, from chilling cold cases to the wild and wacky. We'll explore it all with a perfect blend of seriousness and humour. My name is Emma.
And I'm Nazia. To keep up to date with what's coming up, be sure to follow us on Instagram at felonious.pod and visit our website feloniouspod.com. We hope you enjoy this episode, so let's get to it. What have we got today?
My finds for this week are two quite strange ones. Well, not strange, just...
a bit bizarre.
Yeah. One of them is from Essex, so, you know, proper standard Essex crime.
Yeah.
This is on ITVX.
That mugshot.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? ITV news website, I guess. And this was from this month, so February 2024. And the headline is, "Smiling Essex shoplifter gave thumbs up to security guard as she stole bottle of wine." So she went to jail. She stole several bottles of wine from different shops across Chelmsford and showed no remorse, apparently. She gave a security guard a thumbs up while leaving.
She looks like she drank it on the way out.
Yeah, she probably did. That's not red lipstick, that's just red wine.
Hence the thumbs up. Got to her head.
So she was arrested and she threw food across her cell when she was in custody, causing damage to cameras and walls.
Are you allowed food when you're held in custody?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, how long was she in custody for? Okay, sorry, that was a stupid question.
I think it's part of human rights that they actually have to feed their inmates.
That's true. I just thought maybe she just got in and, yeah, okay, she was held in custody for a while. That makes sense. Sorry, yeah. I'm very tired, so I'm going to ask a lot of stupid questions.
So she admitted to the charges of theft. And the criminal damage came to £5,000. And she was sentenced to a 12-month prison sentence.
That's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Well, she's a repeat offender wants to damage property.
Sounds like she needs to go into some sort of addiction service.
Yeah, it does a little bit. But I just like this sentence at the end of the article. "Chelmsford has a great city centre, which is enjoyed by many people, and we will continue to make it a safe place for the public to work and shop." I fucking hated Chelmsford when I visited it.
I'm trying to remember. I don't think I've ever... No, I've done a marathon there. I've run 40 kilometres in Chelmsford. That was quite nice, but running's nice because you mainly get nice people. Whereas when you're doing other sort of activities, you might not come across very nice people.
Yeah.
Like going shopping in the city centre where people are stealing bottles of wine.
And chucking food around the place.
I've been to Chelmsford once and that was just to do a little run. It was quite nice. It was a nice route. Mm. But
I don't, Chelmsford just reminded me of an upmarket Romford.
It is a bit, isn't it?
Yeah. That's what Kingston's like as well. I'm sorry for the people that live in Chelmsford and Kingston upon Thames.
I know people from Kingston. I have been to Kingston, but I can't remember it very well. But Kingston is like a halfway house between London and Surrey.
Yeah, Romford.
Well, Romford's a halfway house of London and Essex. Do you know what pisses me off is when people from Surrey try to claim that they're from London and it's like, no, you're really not. Stop trying.
Yeah, that's a bit like us as well because our address used to be like listed as Essex.
It is, yeah, it is Essex, but we're Greater London.
Greater London, yeah. Joined with Dagenham.
Yeah, but we're in the TFL.
Yeah, in the right TFL zone, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas, the reason why I say that is when I did my first massage therapy course, there was another student and on the first day, we all had to introduce ourselves. And she went before me and she was like, I'm probably the only Londoner here, actually, because there were a lot of foreign students, but she was trying to make out she was the only Londoner here.
Did she actually speak like that with a posh accent?
I don't know, probably not, but she didn't speak with a London accent, that's for sure. And then it came to me and I was like, well, actually, I was born in Brick Lane, which is in London, and I grew up in Barking, which is in London. And it turns out she's actually just from Surrey. But she just thought, oh, I'm in a room full of foreigners. I can get away with this bullshit. But yeah, it pissed me off. And she was a bit of an annoyed. I hope she never listens to this podcast, actually.
Turns out she's our greatest fan.
But yeah, she was just one of those people that tried to claim that she was the only Londoner. And she wasn't even from London. She wasn't anywhere near London.
Were you like in your Cockney accent? Fuck off, mate.
Exactly. I'm trying to remember. I probably did try and put on a Cockney accent. But I was just like, I was actually born in London, like
East
as
End.
Far, yeah, exactly. But yeah. Anyway, what's the next one?
Okay, the next one is weird.
That mugshot does look weird.
Yeah. So this one is thief who stole dummies from babies in their prams is jailed.
Ew.
Yeah. It's a strange one, this. So a homeless man snatched dummies from babies.
So if we've got any American listeners, so that's pacifiers?
Pacifiers, yeah. Or soothers.
Yeah.
So he stole them from the mouths of young babies in four separate incidents.
And on one occasion, there was an assault.
Yeah, a child was assaulted. It doesn't say anything further on that.
Yeah. He uses the dummy to soothe.
That was, if you didn't hear Nazia clearly. He uses a dummy to soothe himself. He said he would take the dummy, then go and sit in the tent and use the dummy. So yeah, it's a strange one.
Oh, that would freak me out. If you need like pacifiers as an adult or dummies as an adult, that's fine. That's your jam. But leave the children alone, you freak.
Yeah, so people of Harlow, wherever that is.
Harlow's in Essex, isn't it?
Yeah, it is in Essex.
It's just a part of Essex that neither of us have been to. I don't even know where in Essex that is.
Neither do I. But we're not from Essex, though, Nazi. We're from London.
No, we're from London.
Yeah, we're Londoners. So, yeah, those were my finds for this week.
Yeah. Oh, that one's freaked me out. But it's not going to freak me out as much as today's episode.
Yeah. In this episode, we'll be discussing Sture Berryval, also known as Thomas Quick, between 1991 to 2002.
I'm not going to be able to say the
Swedish name.
Yeah, very well. Just FYI. Anyway, yeah, carry on. Sorry.
He was known as one of Sweden's most notorious serial killers, and he confessed to over 30 murders while he was detained in a psychiatric hospital. He was convicted for 8 of the murders he confessed to. In 2001, he stopped cooperating with the police, stopped his therapy sessions, and hid from the spotlight for 7 years. He met with a journalist, Hannes Rahlstam, who made a documentary about him in 2008. He recanted all of his confessions at that time during the documentary and had all of his convictions quashed in 2013. So why did he retract his confessions, and did he really commit these murders? Or was it all a big miscarriage of justice, the biggest in Swedish history?
So this episode is going to be split into 3 parts. I think this part's going to be probably the shortest out of the 3, isn't it?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So we're going to ease you in. So part 1 will focus on Sture Bergwall's early life. Again, I do apologise for the pronunciation of the name. My muscles don't work the same way. I can't do Scandinavian. So yeah, it will focus on his early life from his birth up until his first murder confession in 1993. And part two will mostly be about his convictions. And part three will look at why he recanted his confessions and what Hannes Rostam found out through his research for his documentary. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of, well, there's going to be discussions around murder, child and sexual abuse, cannibalism, drug use, alcoholism, my bastardization of Swedish names and Norwegian names and any other Scandinavian name.
My perfect pronunciations of Swedish terms and names.
Yeah, I mean, you're fine.
I say that with a hint of sarcasm.
It's still miles better than mine. And yeah, so most of the research has been taken from Hannes, his book, which was it's called Thomas Quick, The Making of a Serial Killer. And then he also did the documentary, The Confessions of Thomas. No, he didn't, did he? Did he do the documentary? No, he did a different one.
No, he didn't do that one, yeah.
He did a Swedish one, which you've watched, but I haven't.
No, I couldn't watch it because it was in really thick Swedish and it didn't have any Swedish subtitles, so it was really difficult for me to get along with. So
okay.
I gave up in like 10 minutes.
Yeah, he discusses his documentary in his book anyway.
Yeah, his book is mostly about the documentary, actually. So
yeah. So The Confessions of Thomas Quick, that was actually a film for production.
Mm.
And then there's another book, The Strange Case of Thomas Quick by Dan Josefsson. And, oh God.
The Murders in Apeyr.
Yeah, that. Which is another documentary.
Yeah, that's a Swedish documentary on Swedish television.
Yeah. So quite a few varying number of sources.
We list all of them on the website anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So if you didn't get anything from my butchered pronunciations, just go on our show notes.
So who was Sture Bjørvall? Sture Bjørvall was born in 1950 in Falun, Sweden. He was one of seven siblings, three sisters and four brothers. Despite having so many siblings, he often felt alone and spent a lot of time by himself. Sture's father, Ove, was a factory worker and his mother, Tira, was a school caretaker. His mother, Tira, was well known in their neighbourhood and described as caring and considerate and was pretty much the sole provider for her seven kids. His brother, Örjan, said that Sture was talented, creative and independent. His brother also said they were never punished as children and never experienced any sexual abuse. Sture's first memories are of when he was about 7 years old and he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. He spent a year in a sanatorium where he was only allowed occasional visits from his parents. He missed the first year at school, and spending a year away from home might explain his anxiety during the rest of his childhood. When he started school, he was bullied and struggled with dyslexia. He would often turn up late to lessons and would often lie about the reason why. At the age of 14, Sture discovered that he was gay. It was a very traumatic time in his life, so he sought refuge in drugs. During this time, in the 1960s, homosexuality was frowned upon and considered to be a psychiatric disorder. In school, he would try and touch his classmates, and so he was considered a problem child during his teenage years. He couldn't talk to anybody about his sexuality, let alone his parents, who were Pentecostal Christians.
Yeah, so even though homosexual activity was legal in Sweden at that point, it had been legal since 1944, as he said, it was still considered a mental illness. And the age of consent, I think at that time, was 18. But just a little fun fact to throw in 1979, Swedes protested the classification of homosexuality being a mental illness by calling in sick to work because they felt gay, which I found hilarious when I was researching this. So yeah, as a result, later that year, homosexuality was declassified as a disease, making Sweden the first European country to do so.
Woohoo!
Yeah, they've got quite progressive, they've had quite progressive LGBTQIA laws compared to other.
Yeah, they're quite liberal over here as well, so.
Yeah.
Stura's favourite drug of choice was trichloroethylene, or TCE, a sweet-smelling solvent used to decrease stools. Due to its harmful effects on the nervous system, it was banned in 1996. Despite his drug-taking at an early age, he was the editor of a school magazine and chairman of the pupils' council. However, he was finding it difficult to ignore his homosexual desires and was charged for making sexual advancements on another boy. His class teacher noted that he admitted to a homosexual inclination. He begged the school not to tell his parents, which they respected. When Stura was 16 years old, his older brother, Sten Ove, was working as a journalist. His work colleague had told him that Stura had been beaten up because of his homosexuality. Sten Ove refused to believe that his brother was gay. During this time, Stura was referred to a psychiatrist who said that his homosexuality would be cured through appropriate psychotherapy. During the psychiatrist's examination, Stura came across as very intelligent, well-spoken, had a lively imagination, and had a talent for acting. However, he would sometimes have outbursts of anger, probably induced by the drug-taking, which he had hidden from everybody. When he was 17, Stura got a job as a janitor in a local bank branch. While at work, he fell for a 14-year-old boy. He had lured the boy into the bank's printed paper store and allegedly touched the boy. The boy then reported this to the police, but no charges were ever brought. Stura then applied to a boarding school for boys who wanted to become part of the clergy and become ordained. One of his brothers was at the same school. Stura's drug abuse worsened during this time, and he was drinking quite heavily. He could not ignore his sexual desires and made advances to his classmates. This made him feel very depressed, and he tried to commit suicide. He was admitted into a psychiatric hospital at the end of 1967, where he asked other patients to smuggle in TCE, which he was very addicted to. In 1968, he was kicked out of boarding school due to his absenteeism and his sexual advances on other students.
I mean, already, just before we continue, he's had...
It's a hectic life.
Yeah, I mean, I think firstly, he's one of seven children. That can't have been easy for his parents at that point. How anyone could equally give seven children the attention they need. Maybe that contributed to his personality. Plus, he was bullied, he had dyslexia, and then he had that separation, that period of separation because of the tuberculosis. But he's already gone through a number of incidents where he's committed these acts, but he's still given opportunities to either work with young boys or take advantage of people. Yeah, it's just not a great start, really, on top of the addiction.
Yeah, and nobody seemed to put two and two together that it might have been drugs.
Yeah, and drugs and just, like, it's not even his, you know, you don't have to be, obviously you don't have to be a homosexual to be an abuser, but like, he's got these foundations growing for the way he's behaving. And then for his brother to deny. So, A, he's scared of his parents knowing. And then his brother's denying his sexuality. So that's just going to manifest.
But he's also denying it himself. And
yeah. But then because it's seen as a psychiatric disorder he's questioning himself. But then acting on it in inappropriate ways.
Mm.
So when he was 18 years old, he was working as a nursing assistant at a hospital. Stura fell in love with a man called Tom, a nursing team leader who was 20 years his senior. Sadly, Tom committed suicide a few months into their relationship. He said about this time, "The happiness I felt, the courage I was beginning to have, turned into something completely different. It turned into a very severe crisis in my life." He started to use more drugs and even more alcohol. During this time, he visited an adult psychiatric clinic. He had become hooked on amphetamine. In his therapy session, he spoke about how his homosexuality was a burden and that he had lost control of his actions. He didn't mention his drug habits, though. The doctor prescribed him tranquilizers, which Stura added to his drug regime. So, going back to what you said, the drugs kind of conflate his actions, but no one's putting the two together.
No.
After this, he sexually molested two boys who were patients at the hospital he worked in. One of the boys was 9 years old and woke up to find Stura in a white doctor's coat touching him, and Stura tried to strangle him to prevent the boy from screaming. He let the boy go when his nose started bleeding. Thinking he had murdered the boy, he ran out of the room. He phoned the hospital exchange from the nursing station and said that the duty doctor should go to where a small boy was dying. He called for a taxi and went to a clergyman he knew. He told the minister about what had happened. He used the minister's phone and left an anonymous message about the boy's murder in the hospital. He then phoned the hospital and his colleague said that the boy was alive. The boy had been found on the floor with a nosebleed and said that he had had a nightmare about a doctor coming into the room and kissing him. Stura went to the police station the next day to turn himself in. The boy at the hospital was examined and there were faint strangulation marks on his neck. Nobody would have noticed this if Stura hadn't confessed. He was convicted of 4 assaults on young teenage boys which happened between March and October 1969. In one case, he grabbed a 13-year-old boy by the scruff of the neck and pulled him into a ditch. The boy called for help and managed to escape. He was considered to be very dangerous and was sentenced to psychiatric care in 1970. In January 1973,
he moved from Sichuan Hospital
to
Serta Hospital,
as it was closer to his hometown. At no point did the hospital try to wean him off his drug habit. They instead replaced them with benzodiazepines, but he was still able to get other drugs from the kiosk inside the hospital.
That's another thing I don't understand, is how that went past people in the hospital. He was able to go to the shop kiosk and get drugs from outside.
All I can assume is back then they didn't have very tight controls on substances.
Yeah, I guess. And I guess security at the time probably wasn't the greatest.
I guess not. Well, I mean, we find out later.
Yeah,
it wasn't
true.
The greatest. So despite his drug addiction, the hospital allowed him to leave to study at university in Uppsala, where he got deeper into drugs and was trying to develop romantic relationships. There was a gay club that he went to, and there he met Lennart Höglund.
Höglund.
Höglund. See, almost. In 1974. They left the club together and ended up at Lennart's apartment, where Stura decided to stab Lennart. He stabbed him 12 times and he tried to run away. Stura was arrested days later and lied in the interviews. He said that he had never met Lennart. Then he admitted to being in his apartment when a third man came in and demanded Stura pay him to sleep with Lennart. Stura was never put on trial for attempted manslaughter or convicted for the stabbing, as he was under psychiatric care. So he was just sent back to the psychiatric hospital on the condition that he be placed in a secure ward for a lengthy period. But a few months later, he was out again. In 1975, while discharged from the hospital, Stura tried to take his own life. He had checked into a motel room with 80 tablets of sedatives and benzodiazepines. He started taking the tablets and then realised he didn't want to die alone, and so called a psychotherapist he met as an outpatient. Stura refused to say where he was, but the psychotherapist was able to trace the call, which saved his life. He was readmitted to Setta.
In February 1976, his father had a stroke and was taken to Setta. Stura visited his father daily, and his behaviour became calmer, so he was given conditional release. He moved in with his mother and seemed to be getting on well without any mental disturbances, according to doctor's notes. His prescription was reduced, and for the next 10 years, he didn't take any other drugs. Stura's father passed away in 1977, and Stura took care of his ailing mother until 1983 when she passed away. He spent most of the 1980s drug-free and spent a lot of his time with his siblings and their children. In 1982, He opened a tobacco shop with his brother, and in 1983, after his mother died, he lived on his own in his parents' house. An 11-year-old boy, Patrick Olofsson, would hang out near the tobacco shop and help with chores, and he looked after Sture's dog. Sture got to know the Olofsson family. In 1986, the tobacco shop he had with his brother closed down, and Sture became unemployed. He then opened another tobacco shop, but with a new partner, Patrick Olofsson's mother, Margit. Many teenage boys would visit the shop and visit Sture at his home. Sture would make all sorts of things for the teenage boys he knew from the shop and would arrange treasure trails. He hired a holiday cottage where they would have sleepovers. On one occasion, the boys watched a horror film at Sture's house, and during a scary scene, Sture held one of the boys' hands. The teenagers thought it was weird, but at no point did Sture molest any of the boys. In 1987, Sture passed his driving test and got a 1965 red Volvo PV, which was very popular with the teenage boys. Sture organised trips to Stockholm with the boys to see heavy metal bands perform. Patrick Olofsson spent a lot of time with Sture and would stay at his house often with his parents' permission. Patrick's parents separated, which led to the tobacco shop closing down after a disagreement between Sture and Margit. Both Sture and Patrick were struggling to survive financially, so they decided to rob a bank. Sture also started to use drugs again. The bank was next door to his old shop, and he was a customer there. On the 14th of December 1990, Patrick and Sture broke into the home of the bank manager and took him and his family hostage. The robbers wore Santa Claus masks and balaclavas to cover their identities, and Sture spoke with a Finnish accent, but he soon forgot and spoke in his normal accent, which led to them both being recognised. They held the family hostage for 3 hours and threatened to kill the bank manager's wife and child. They were arrested immediately after the robbery. Patrick, who was 18 years old, got sentenced and received 3.5 years. Sture was assessed by psychologists and committed to Seattle Hospital in 1991. Journalist Hannes Rolstam asked Sture Bereval in 2008 about the time when he owned the tobacco shop, and he said it was the best time of his life. He said he felt guilty about what he did to Patrick and his family. Säter Hospital is one of the 5 big hospitals in Sweden that was built for people sentenced to forensic psychiatric treatment. Sture's siblings stopped talking to him at this time and didn't want anything to do with him. Sture said that he was very lonely during this period and very unhappy. During Sture's assessment period, Göran Fransson, who was a chief physician at Säter Hospital, offered his opinion on Sture in a report requested by the courts to see if Sture needed a more extensive psychiatric evaluation. His opinion included judgments and speculations about Sture having committed, which were at the time, undiscovered crimes. And this is a quote from the report. "The crime for which he has been convicted shows signs of serious sexual perversions, where the risk of repeat offences is high. It seems surprising that he has not been prosecuted on other occasions for such crimes."
One thing that I've just thought of is Sweden didn't have a sex offenders registry at that time either.
Interesting. I meant to look that up.
Yeah, I just had a quick look. I think it was introduced in 1997. Because it just occurred to me, like, especially, you know, when he was hanging out with young boys, and although they didn't report any
abuse.
Yeah, any abuse. But like, if people were aware of his previous crimes, he would never have been allowed near, and he wouldn't have got those jobs that he got.
Yeah, he would have had to have a check and...
Yeah, yeah, like his life would have been very different.
Mm.
So yeah, just in case anyone else was wondering, Sweden didn't have a sex offenders registration at that time. So yeah, Säter Hospital was very progressive with an ambitious treatment plan, with a want for criminals to get involved with therapy so that they could understand themselves and to understand why they had committed their crimes. The main theory that most had at Säter was that these criminals mostly had traumatic childhoods, including periods of sexual abuse, which is why they had committed their crimes. They believed their memories were repressed and were hopeful that if they could encourage the patients to remember their childhood trauma, then the want and need to commit crimes would disappear. Stuart suffered from bouts of suicidal thoughts at this time, as he felt immense sorrow for what had happened to his friend Patrick Olofsson, whom he had robbed the bank with. Stuart pleaded with his therapists for psychotherapy, which he had gone through before. During those sessions, he did not offer any memories of his childhood that were of interest. Then he realised the therapists were after traumatic experiences. As already mentioned, psychoanalysis makes the assumption that certain personality traits can be traced back to sexual abuse in childhood. Stürer read books about this in the hospital's library, so he told the therapists what they wanted to hear, and he got what he wanted, which was human interaction. Stürer developed a particular relationship with a doctor called
Kjell Pearson.
Yes, because that's how it's spelt. He was not a psychotherapist, but he led a lot of the therapy sessions with Stürer. In spring 1992, Stürer was admitted to the high security ward in Seta. He suffered from severe bouts of anxiety and he was given diazepam and other narcotic drugs to help calm him down. In the summer of that year, doctors came to the conclusion that Stürer was stable and was given full clearance, which meant he was allowed to roam around the community during the day as he pleased. At no point in his files at this particular point are the sessions mentioned with Kjell Pearson when Stürer discussed past sexual abuse and violence. Also, in June 1992, Stürer made an application to change his name to Thomas Quick. That's going to make our lives easier. which was approved, and he also signed a lease on an apartment. By September, however, he realised he couldn't afford to pay the rent, so gave up the lease and remained at Seta Hospital. During his therapy sessions with Kjell Pearson, Stürer remembered he had travelled to Sundsvall, where he murdered Johan Asplund in 1980. And that is his first confession. That is probably our shortest episode ever. Don't let that fool you, because we're going to make up for it next time, aren't we?
Oh, yes.
That is a very, very quick introduction.
But he's already got a chaotic life. And,
yeah.
He's already trying to find ways not to feel so lonely.
It's a really, really bad recipe for disaster, though, isn't it? Like, he's got his issues about his sexuality.
His drug abuse.
He is a sex offender, even though there's no registry. That is what he is. And then he's put into psychiatric care, which has, you know, good intentions. Mm. But when he realises that he's not as interesting as the other patients,
he starts to invent stories.
Yeah, and you can kind of see how this is turning out to... It's a recipe for disaster, really.
It's a clusterfuck.
Yeah, yeah. And I think... Doesn't he explain in the documentary why he changed his name to Thomas Quick? It's like Thomas the Fast or something.
Yeah, but his mother, her maiden name was Quick. So, Quick.
Right. But at least next episode, it will be easier to say his name for me.
Yeah, so Stürer Berivel is Thomas Quick, and Thomas Quick is Stürer Berivel.
Yeah, yeah. So as you said, it's already a chaotic life.
And it's either in the next episode or in the third part that we find out more about his family as well.
Yeah, because I'm sure there's a lot of question marks now, like where is his family in all of this?
Mm.
And yeah.
Yeah, so part two will discuss the 8 murder cases that he was actually found guilty for and he confessed to.
And it's going to be a long one, that one. That is going to be a clusterfuck.
Yeah. I don't think we'll even have time for banter in that one. I think it's going to be like a straight deep dive.
Yeah, I did find an article for banter, but I'll save it for the end because we'll probably need it as a palate cleanser. As in, I'll save it for part three if we even have time. So next one is serious business.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't done a multi-parter since Charles Sobrage, so...
Well, we did a multi-parter for Stockholm Syndrome, but yeah, a major multi-parter, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So, yeah, hope you enjoyed this short episode.
Yeah, catch us on Spotify, Amazon Music and Apple Podcasts for this part two and part three. And all the other episodes that we've released so far.
Yes.
We've had some good ones, like you mentioned. We've had Charles Sobhraj.
Yeah.
Liliane Bettencourt.
Yeah.
Stockholm Syndrome. Bangladesh Bank Heist. The Puppet Master.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like us and subscribe. What have you got to lose?
Yeah. And let us know what you think. We're always happy with feedback.
Yeah, please let us know. And, yeah, we'll see you next Tuesday.
See you next Tuesday. Thank you for listening to the show. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can find more information about the show on our website at feloniouspod.com or on our Instagram at feloniouspod.
Links to our show notes can be found in the episode description, as well as through our website and social media. You can visit our Contact Us page and tell us what you think about the show and if there are any cases you would like us to cover. We hope you join us for the next episode. Goodbye.
Bye.